Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news and information, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Christina, and I will be reading with Mary. We will be reading from both the Eagle Tribune and the Lowell Sun. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Starting with the Eagle Tribune. Lawmakers, military action in Venezuela is legal. Members of the state's Democratic Congressional Delegation want to rein in President Donald Trump's illegal war in Venezuela and prevent taxpayer dollars from being used to occupy the South American country after toppling its autocratic leadership. Over the weekend, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife were captured by the U.S. Special Forces in a dramatic raid at the presidential palace in Curaçao before they were brought to New York to face drug trafficking and weapon charges. Trump told reporters Saturday the U.S. will run Venezuela until a safe and proper judicious transition can take place. The move came after weeks of U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean region, which included the destruction of suspected drug boats and the seizure of oil tankers. But House Minority Whip Catherine Clark said Democratic leaders in Congress were kept in the dark about the military intervention, who are now demanding answers and accountability for the Trump administration about its plans to oversee Venezuela and control its oil deposits. Our Constitution states very clearly that only Congress has the power to declare war, the revered Democrat said in a statement. The House and Senate must be briefed immediately on this unauthorized use of military action and what comes next. The U.S. Senate is expected to vote on a resolution this week that would block the use of the armed forces to engage in hostilities within or against Venezuela unless authorized by Congress. Similar Democratic resolutions have previously failed to pass amid Republican oppositions. Representative Seth Moulton, who backs a vote on a war powers resolution, is also calling for Congress to take up his proposal to prohibit the U.S. military from spending taxpayer funds on additional operations inside Venezuela or against Venezuelan forces, including remote or intermittent strikes unless Congress authorizes military action. We need to have that vote in Congress, said Moulton, a former Marine captain who served for combat tours of duty in Iraq. Taxpayers shouldn't be funding an illegal war. We've got a lot of problems in America today, and invading, occupying, and running Venezuela does not solve any of them. The Justice Department alleges that Maduro is a narco-terrorist who oversaw a corrupt, illegitimate government that for decades has leveraged government power to protect and promote illegal activity, including drug trafficking. He faces a four-count federal indictment that includes drug trafficking and weapons charges. That drug trafficking has enriched and entrenched Venezuela's political and military elite, the DOJ wrote in the 25-page complaint against Maduro. The cycle of narcotics-based corruption lines the pockets of Venezuelan officials and their families, while also benefiting violent narco-terrorists who operate with impunity on Venezuelan soil and who help produce, protect, and transport tons of cocaine to the United States. Federal prosecutors secured a grand jury indictment against Maduro in 2020. Most recently, the government placed a $50 million reward tips leading to his apprehension. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were arraigned before the federal judge in New York City Monday afternoon. They both pleaded not guilty to the charges. They are both due back in court March 17th, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for Southern New York. Republicans have praised the president's actions, framing Maduro as a national security threat to the U.S. and the Western Hemisphere, who needed to be removed from power. They've pointed out that Trump's predecessor, Democrat Joe Biden, imposed sanctions and set a $25 million reward for tips leading to Maduro's apprehension. Amy Carnevale, chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party, said the intervention in Venezuela and Maduro's capture represented landmark leadership by the U.S. in the war on transnational narco-terrorism. Thanks to the decisive leadership of President Trump, Nicolas Maduro will finally be held accountable for his heinous crimes, Carnevale said in statement. The world is safer as a result of American leadership. Democrats say while they support bringing Maduro to justice for his crimes against the U.S. and Venezuelan people, they argue the Trump administration violated international laws and put U.S. soldiers at risk by unilaterally attacking the country and capturing its leader. Maduro is a brutal dictator with horrific human rights record who used force to cling to power after losing an election, Representative Jim McGovern, a Worcester Democrat, said in a statement. It is entirely possible to hate Maduro and also to strongly condemn the decision to remove him by force. President Trump did not seek congressional authorization for this use of force, and Congress did not grant it, McGovern added. Under our Constitution and the law, that makes this action illegal. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Christina. Good morning. Welfare swindle. Mass Native reports and provides inside look at SNAP fraud. A Massachusetts native on the national front line of targeting SNAP fraud says Bay State lacks control, enable an alleged operation that obtained nearly $7 million in benefits out of tiny storefronts in Boston. Haywood Chalcove, a Danvers native who heads LexisNexis Solutions, government division, has accompanied the Secret Service on raids that have busted schemes taking advantage of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. In those enforcement actions, he's found operations that he says resemble the one uncovered in Mattapan before the new year. What you saw in Massachusetts is happening literally across the country with those convenience stores, Talcove told the Herald after the feds announced a pair of arrests in connection with alleged criminal enterprise on Blue Hill Avenue. Talcove has traveled to San Diego, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and Miami with the Secret Service over the past 2 years in an attempt to crack down on SNAP fraud. A bulk of the fraudulent activity, he said, occurs in small bodegas, similar to the two storefronts that total just 650 square feet. Inside one targeted Los Angeles business, Talcove recalled there was a bag of cocaine. There was a bag of cocaine and cash and no food to be found. The raid uncovered how the store owner received SNAP benefits, he said. Talcove added that the owner likely told friends and family how to apply for EBT cards. And once in hand, they've come to the store to receive cocaine or cash. If you were a USDA inspector and you walked in, unless you were visually challenged, Talcove said, you would realize this really wasn't a store. Last April, Talcove traveled to Las Vegas with the Secret Service to conduct a payment card skimming fraud operation. In that action, authorities removed four skimming devices, preventing a potential loss of an estimated nearly $1.3 million. Talcove recounted how one of the fraudulent business was located near a homeless encampment, and all the food in the store was dated, including Raisin Bran, that expired in 2022, but cost $11. they were allowing people to trade in their EBT cards for beer and cash, Talkov said. There was no reason to have this bodega, this convenience store being able to resell EBT. Within the past, Talkov hasn't testified before Congress twice. In these instances, he exposed the scale and sophistication of fraud targeting governing programs. Transitional fraud rings, terrorist organizations, and domestic criminal enterprises, he said, have moved beyond pandemic relief and now target core social programs with the same tactics, leveraging stolen identities and synthetic identities, cider collusion. Talkov has focused on individuals he describes as first-person fraudsters, people he says often overstate their lost income, fail to disclose employment, or misinterpret eligibility details. He says a second group of people is perhaps more insidious, one he calls the insider threat. These cases involved government employees entrusted with administering these programs who instead exploit the position to facilitate fraud, he told Congress on February 6, 2025. Talkov leads efforts to stop fraud, streamline government services, and protect taxpayer resources. His organization issued a report last September finding that the average monthly rate of applications in post-issuance cases determined a SNAP fraud has doubled since 2024. That has resulted in a sharp increase in fraud cost. The report states, for every $1 value of benefits lost through fraud, it actually costs SNAP agencies 4.14 up to 3.93 in 2024, it found. Talkov said, exploding SNAP fraud is due to a lack of action at the state and federal levels. Massachusetts Attorney General Lee Foley blamed the State Department transition assistant for failing to prevent the alleged SNAP fraud scheme in Mattapan, while Governor Maura Healey said her administration reported the suspicious activity to the feds. Antonio Bonher, 74, a naturalized U.S. citizen from Haiti, living in Mattapan, and Saul Alisme, 21, a Haitian national residing in Hyde Park, each face one count of food stamp fraud in connection with the scheme. The defendants' monthly SNAP redemptions alleged range from $100,000 to $500,000 per month, an amount that the Fed said it's larger than full-service supermarket. Talkov told the Herald that Massachusetts doesn't allow best practices and verify data that SNAP applicants provide to third parties, and it uses a rules-backed check to ensure applications are filled out correctly, but stops there. That means self-reported information is never challenged, Talkov said. He added that the state doesn't run SNAP recipient data against the background of bodega owners, a group in which he estimates 10% also receive food stamps. On the other hand, Talkov said the USDA has spent less than 1% on SNAP program integrity, allowing fraud to run rampant. He also points to the Fed's delaying full adoption of the so-called National Accuracy Clearinghouse, a pilot program that has identified over 14 million cases of duplicate participation on Medicaid, SNAP, and other programs. If the USDA were able to increase its investment in retail integrity programs operation, Talgo said, and the state actually check the data on the applicant, there's probably $18 billion that can go to the food insecure or go back to taxpayers or some combination. Oh, well, it's inexcusable. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you, Mary. First Tracks Ski Bradford gears up for a flurry of families. Haverhill. Like fresh powder, thousands of skiers and snowboarders dropped in on the slopes and half pipes at Bradford's winter sports destination over the weekend. In December, the hill launched its 76th season, bringing bundled up brothers, sisters, mothers, and grandfathers to Ski Bradford. What looks like effortless fun from the hilltops is truly a fine-tuned operation of patrolling, lift maintenance, and plenty of snowmaking. As the ski area spans 60 acres with 15 trails and roughly 65 hours of operation each week, many don't realize the fact that the real engine behind Bradford is its people. There are about 250 employees and volunteers who keep people moving on the mountain. According to Dennis Gavin, Ski Bradford's market manager, the rental shop employs about 30 people. The ski school includes roughly 120 instructors. Lift operators add another 50 workers, while the kitchen and parking crews each employ about a dozen staff members. There are also 84 ski patrollers needed to monitor the slopes, he added. There's a whole lot in the background that goes on, Gavin said, and it's all to make skiing as easy and convenient for those who come. Gavin clocks in at his office adjacent to the cozy ski lodge with a walkie-talkie regularly buzzing from the breast pocket of his windbreaker. Next door, his wife Carol works in group sales, coordinating the dozens of school programs that will soon send their little ones to Bradford by the busload for lessons. Beginning Monday, the Ski Bradford school program kicked into high gear as Gavin called it organized chaos. Anywhere from 800 to 1,000 students from schools across the Merrimack Valley and beyond arrive weekly for after-school lessons, and the instructors have their hands full. Bradford prepares in the early fall for the surge of schoolboys and girls by mapping out age groups and meeting locations, funneling the shuffling boots to separate slopes. At the base of a very shallow incline, a magic carpet for beginners lifts the youngest skiers uphill for their first lessons. The toddlers in training practice their pizza and french fry formations as a swarm of instructors guide every glide. Nearby, Nikita Shah watched her 5-year-old daughter, Elena, take her first steps on skis while her 8-year-old son, Ivan, cruised down a more challenging hill nearby. Shah said her son has been skiing at Ski Bradford since he was 4. All of my family skis and learns here at Ski Bradford, so now we are starting with my daughter because it's a great place for them to begin, Shah said. More families crowd the ski lodge, snapping helmets and buckling boots, while others peel off gloves and goggles, rosy-cheeked after their first ski lessons of the year. Betty Willette, a supervisor helping her own crew of visitors nearby, has worked at Ski Bradford for more than 3 decades. You have to love it, she said. We love the kids and love to teach them. That's all. Some of the children that ski here would never have the opportunity to ski if we didn't have Bradford. Ski Bradford is what Willette called a feeder mountain, a smaller, community-based hill where skiers learn the fundamentals before graduating to larger mountains and steeper slopes. It's a community skill ski hill that aims to emphasize affordability, accessibility, and familiarity. Gavin said that he learned to ski at Ski Bradford in the 1950s and later taught his own children, grandchildren, and great-granddaughter on the same slopes. We'll have generations that come here, Gavin said. There will be grandparents, their kids, then their kids, and great-grandchildren, all on the hill over the years, and they just keep coming. Ski Bradford is expected to run through mid-March, depending upon the weather. The hill is open 7 days a week, including weekdays, weeknights, and weekends. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Christina. A flu shot can dilute effects of current strain. flu cases in Boston and across Massachusetts continued to racket up due in part to a new variant, as public health officials remind everyone that it's not too late to get inoculated. This flu season, we're concerned about this new variant that is circulating, said State Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein on a recent WCBB segment. We saw it circulating in Europe, in Japan, and in other parts of the world, and is here in Massachusetts. All the Massachusetts health experts concur with that assessment. We are seeing a very high level of influenza-like illnesses right now, Dr. Larry Madoff, Medical Director for the Bureau of Infectious Diseases and Laboratory Sciences at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, told NBC 10 Boston. We are seeing early and large amounts of patients' activity in emergency rooms, urgent cares, and hospitalization, he added. There's quite a bit of flu activity at the hospital, said Dr. Paul Sachs, infectious disease specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Many people who are coming in for evaluation who are getting tested for the flu turn out to be positive. There is a positive test rate as high as 10% in people coming in. In the most recent weeks, reports ending on December 27, Massachusetts registered over 8,800 lab-confirmed flu cases, up from about 7,200 the prior week, and far more than the under 3,200 cases identified just 2 weeks before, according to the state flu dashboard. State officials categorized flu activity in Massachusetts as very high, while flu severity reached high in the most recent weeks. Across the state, influenza accounted for 9% of hospitalizations compared to just 5% the week before, according to dashboard data, which also shows 30 flu-related deaths so far this season. In the Boston, cases rose to 748 in the most recent week, reported a slight upstick from 712 the week before. The city flu dashboard indicated Boston also reported that 11.3% of emergency department visits included flu-like illnesses, up to 7.2% the prior week. In a typical flu season, it's not expected to see a spike immediately after the holiday when friends and family gather in large numbers. However, this continued rise comes a week after Boston health officials warned of an early surge in flu cases this year, rising by 114% in early December and even higher for cases in children. The CDC has warned of a new flu variant, subclade K, spreading across the U.S. after rapidly spreading across United Kingdom, Japan, and Canada. More than half of U.S. states report very, very high levels of illnesses, the CDC says. At the end of December, New York State experienced one of its worst single weeks for flu hospitalizations in years, while Connecticut has seen similar surge. The subclade K strain, a mutated version of one of the two subtypes of type A flu, H3N2, has shown to be immune to some of the vaccine's protective properties. By itself, H3N2 can cause serious illnesses, especially in older adults. The CDC has stated that it's too soon to predict how severe this season will become. But the state's low vaccination numbers will probably help extend its stay. According to mass.gov, as of December 27, only 34.1% of Massachusetts residents had received a flu shot, well below last flu season, 38.5%. That low vaccination rate combined with this flu strain resistance therapies has facilitated this spread. Dr. Zachary Binder, a pediatric emergency medical center, told Northeast Public Radio, WAMC, the flu shot issue has been a tricky one this year. Annual vaccinations are usually developed to take on the likely predominant strain or strains of the upcoming season. This year has featured a bit of a mismatch, with the current vaccine offering not matching the most dominant, the subclade K variant, making headlines across the country. That being said, all recommendations from the CDC and elsewhere are still to get the flu shot that it does, even with that mismatch, and occur protection against hospitalization and death. Binder, the associate professor of pediatrics at UMass Chan Medical School, told WAMC, as pediatricians, we are usually exceeding pro-vaccine across the board, and there's no exception to the flu shot. The state's public health commissioner agrees. Goldstein said there is not a perfect match between this vaccine and the variant that's circulating, but nonetheless urged residents to get vaccinated. It still provides significant protection, Goldstein said. We know this from other parts of the world, where we've seen people who get vaccinated are protected. There is likely to end up in hospital. There is less likely to end up in hospitals, less likely to be out of work for a long period. The vaccine still works, and people should still get it. Fortunately, ample flu shots remain available. A major pharmacy chains like CVS, Walmart, urgent care centers, primary care, and municipal health departments. It's best to make an appointment to ensure seamless shot experience. And please, if you're sick, stay home from work or school. But if you must go out, wear a mask. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you, Mary. Coming out of Windham, New Hampshire, petitioners want building ban on ballot. Selectmen considered, then balked at the idea, citing legal concerns. A citizen's petition filed by a planning board member seeks voter approval to halt residential and mixed-use development after the board opted not to advance its own version of a growth management ordinance. The petition, filed by Matt Rounds, asked voters in March to adopt a growth management ordinance that would pause development for an undetermined period, providing relief to the school district and the capacity concerns. The citizens' petition, including the proposed growth management ordinance, will be discussed at a public hearing on January 7th. Rounds gathered 60 signatures before submitting the petition to the town on December 10th, hours before the planning board's scheduled workshop to discuss its own draft ordinance. Signatories included board members Jack Gattinella, Payel Balaya, Derek Monsoon, and Raja Hohenberg. Not all town officials are on board. There was a several-month-long process to define an ordinance, taking input from other planning board members, the public, and legal counsel. And then when that input doesn't go the way you would like it to, you submit a citizen's petition doing the same, ignoring a good portion of that input, said Selectman Heath Partington in response to the citizen's petition. Round's version of the ordinance, which shares language with the board's draft, seeks to regulate the timing of residential development to ensure K through 8 educational facilities remain adequate and below functional capacity. According to data included in the ordinance, most grades are over or nearing recommended functional capacity and student-to-teacher ratios. The ordinance would apply to all residential development that proposes dwelling units, including subdivisions, site plans, multifamily, or mixed-use development, and conversions to year-round residential use. It would not apply to certain workforce housing, age-restricted housing, renovations, or approved but unbuilt units. As a conservative, I cannot sit back and watch our taxes climb higher year after year while the town continues approving unchecked growth without any financial accountability, said resident Alex Inglis in support of the citizens' petition. Families in Windham are already stretched thin, and the idea of adding even more tax burden, especially when developers are paying next to nothing, is absolutely unacceptable. Inglis said he believes the petition should go before voters in March. Not having it go to warrant would be nothing more than the government shutting the people out of their own future, he said. If adopted, the ordinance would require the planning board to update the town's master plan and capital improvement plan within 1 year to coordinate future K-8 facility planning. The ordinance would then be reviewed every 5 years. At its December 10th meeting, a majority of the board concluded that its own version of the Growth Management Ordinance, drafted as an alternative to a proposed moratorium, was not legally sound or ready for the March ballot. We need to spend this next year coming up with a study for growth management, Balaya said. We need to look at when was the highest growth burst for the town and how it was handled, then come up with how many subdivisions we should allow in a year, how many permits should be issued in a year. Restricting all of it just on school numbers is not doing justice. Malaya added that limiting the analysts to the school district alone would be a disservice, noting that population growth also affects municipal services like public safety, water and sewer systems, and road maintenance. The growth maintenance ordinance filed by Rounds focuses on school capacity, particularly at the Golden Brook School, which is just 45 students from reaching structural capacity. Data generated using a formula from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development indicates the district cannot afford to absorb even one additional student. The school district has to take all children that come in, Round said. Tomorrow, if 500 students showed up on the steps of the GBS, they would have to take them. But when the school was at double capacity, we had kids with their homerooms in hallways. It was so crowded. Rounds argued that the impact on the school district was more urgent than the effect on other municipal services. Certain members of the planning board are dragging their feet, and when my child is learning in a hallway, lawsuits from developers will be the least of your worries, said Johnny Kincaid. Hohenberg remained reluctant to move forward with the board's version of the ordinance, highlighting concerns raised by town attorney Bernie Campbell and data from a third-party study conducted by a professional planner. The Figuri study brought up an important point, Hohenberg said. In the last 5 years, we've built 500 houses, but our student population went down. To make a direct correlation between new housing starts and student population increases needs a lot of study and documentation. Although Hohenberg and Balaya opposed advancing the board's ordinance, both expressed support for Round's citizens' petition, which could reduce the town's risk of potential lawsuits. No one is disagreeing with the statement, the direction, the methodology, the need for this, said Vice Chair Tom Early. But we want a defensible source of documents to back this up. We need to organize them and be able to discuss them as a group if we're serious about getting this done. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Christina. Connector reports health insurance enrollment churn. The number of Massachusetts residents who dropped insurance access through the state health connector was roughly balanced out by those who signed up for plans through the state exchange. Nearly 23,000 Bay Staters terminated their coverage so far this open enrollment cycle, while 23,596 people newly signed up for plans through the connector said spokesperson Jason Lefters. The volume of residents who chose not to renew for 2026 is more than double the decline that the Health Connector recorded at this point last cycle, when 11,300 people dropped their coverage, Lefters said. It is unclear what those members may have alternatively sought insurance, though Executive Director Audrey Moores-Gastier has warned people may be tempted by junk coverage. The number of new enrollees is about 2,000 fewer than at this point last year, according to the Connector's open enrollment dashboard. The dashboard notes that individuals who qualify for subsidized coverage in 2026, either because of a loss of federal subsidies or they were already unsubsidized in 2025, are more likely to have canceled their 2026 coverage than other types of current enrollees. Connector officials will continue to monitor payment activity to determine whether individuals are likely to lose coverage as a result of non-payment, particularly among individuals losing subsidies for their 2026 coverage, the dashboard said. Enhancing premium tax credit expired Wednesday under a 2022 federal law. The expiring subsidies have led to skyrocketing health insurance premiums for some residents, and people contacting the Health Connector call center in recent months have voiced emotional dirges over the sticker shock. As of December 29, the Connector's enrollment for January 2026 stands out of 371,000, Lefters said. Based on December 28 data, said the enrollment has experienced a 1% reduction compared to December 2025. While we are glad that our extensive outreach efforts have resulted in 23,500 more people signing up for health insurance coverage through the Health Connector, we continue to see negative impacts that President Trump and Congressional Republicans' refusal to extend ACA premium tax credits are having on health insurance costs, Moores-Gastier said. Hundreds and thousands of Massachusetts residents are seeking their premiums increase as much as $25,000, and we've seen thousands more terminate their coverage than unusual. Last January, the Health Connector was celebrating record-high enrollment. Nearly 30,000 people were enrolled in a new, trying to find my page here, a new age. And about 85% of all members were enrolled heavily subsidized Connector Care plans. Congressional Republicans and Democrats this year did not reach consensus on subsidy extensions. In the U.S. Senate, on December 11th, both a Republican-backed bill to boost payments for the health savings account and a Democrat-backed bill to extend subsidies by 3 years did not secure enough votes. Under federal policy changes, individuals who earn below 100% of the federal poverty level and have previously qualified for Connector Care are no longer eligible. People earning between 400% to 500% of the federal poverty level are no longer eligible for Connector Care, and a subset of people earning above $500,000 will not receive other premium credits. Audrey Shelto of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation has estimated around 300,000 residents will lose their insurance through MassHealth or the Connector due to federal policy changes. In a radio interview last week, Governor Mara Healey said officials are exploring ways to ensure Bay Staters enroll in other health insurance options. State law requires to be enrolled in coverage that meets certain standards, otherwise they'll face the tax penalty. Healy did not directly answer a question from a caller who urged her to dip into the state's $8 billion rainy day fund to mitigate the impact of federal funding cuts. I will say I am focused as we move into this budget season on making sure that we do what we need to do to protect the most vulnerable among us, Healy said. Analyst says the state uninsured rate is suspected to double due to provisions in One Big Beautiful Bill Act. A recent survey pinned the rate at 2.1%, meaning 139,741 Massachusetts residents are uninsured. At the end of 2025, the Connector had a total enrollment of 389,260 individuals, including 49,399 enrolled in unsubsidized plans, and 331,725 in Connector Care plans, according to the dashboard. Going into 2026, the Connector has 96,279 individuals enrolled in unsubsidized plans and 274,876 enrolled in Connecticut Care plans, according to the dashboard as of December 28. Base daters face a December 23 deadline to sign up for coverage that starts on January 1st. Open enrollment continues through January 23rd, and residents can still sign up for coverage that takes effect on February 1. People who need coverage and our members who are still considering their options should take action before the end of open enrollment January 23rd and find a plan to deliver the coverage that they need for the new year, Morris Gastia said. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you, Mary. Haverhill holds inauguration ceremony. Mayor Melinda Barrett and city officials were sworn in Monday morning during Haverhill's inauguration ceremony, launching the new two-year municipal term. The ceremony was held in the Nicholas J. Ross Auditorium at Haverhill City Hall, located at 4 Summer Street, and city leaders, state legislators, and public safety officials and residents shared the room for the occasion. Barrett is entering her second term after winning re-election on November 4th by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. In her inaugurational address, she spoke to Haverhill's strengths in community, public safety, and economic development while recalling challenges faced throughout 2025. The mayor said, "Haverhill is a city made up of almost 36 square miles and home to almost 70,000 residents. That's a lot of land and a lot of people, and some people might think that means it's hard to find belonging and community here, but that couldn't be further from the truth." Barrett referenced Haverhill's response during last year's federal government shutdown, when nearly 15,000 residents did not receive their November Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits on time or in full. She recognized the city's efforts in organizing a food drive at the Haverhill Citizen Center and coordinating food donations among pantries, hot meal providers, and schools. She mentioned that the Haverhill Police Department endured back-to-back tragedies last year, beginning with the death of Francis Gigliotti. Barrett said the investigation into Gigliotti's death by the district attorney's office is ongoing, and that loss, paired with the death of Haverhill's police officer, Caitlin Tully, in September, has weighed heavily on the department. Yet they have never ceased to deliver excellent services to the community, she said. Barrett thanked Police Chief Wayne Tracy, Deputy Chief Megan Parr, members of the department, and the late Tully for their commitment to public service. Recognizing the Haverhill Fire Department for their service, the mayor announced leadership changes as Fire Chief Robert O'Brien is set to retire January 17th, after 31 years of service. Deputy Fire Chief and EMS Coordinator Christopher Siesti, a 30-year veteran, will succeed him. Eric Tarpey, another veteran of the department, will serve in the newly created role of Assistant Fire Chief. Barrett said the department will receive new equipment, including a pump truck arriving in February and a ladder truck later this summer. The city continues to pursue the acquisition of federal and state land for a new fire station on Route 97, she added. Public safety is and will continue to be a priority for my administration, she said. Barrett also announced staffing changes in City Hall, including the retirement of City Engineer John Petitis, who left at the end of 2025. Longtime Economic Development and Planning Director William Pillsbury retired after 36 years, as did Assistant Economic Development Director Pamela Price. Pillsbury's role will be split into two positions, and Jackie Bierley, a former town planner in Andover, has been hired as Planning Director. The city is still searching for an Economic Development Director. Haverhill is a place where we can count on one another for support, especially in the face of adversity, Barrett said. There is a lot of work we can all do by looking out for our neighbors and spreading empathy and kindness. Members of the Haverhill City Council were also welcomed into the new term. Councilors at large, Timothy Jordan, John Mitchitson, Thomas Sullivan, and Colin LePage were inaugurated, along with ward councilors Ralph Bisellery, Devin Ferreira, Melissa Lewandowski, Sean Tui, Michael McGonnell, Catherine Rogers, and Daniel Diodati. Diodati represented Ward 2, is the only newcomer to the council after winning in November. The council elected Jordan as council president, succeeding Sullivan, and named Mitchitson vice president. In his remarks, Jordan outlined challenges facing the city, including anticipated federal funding decreases for nonprofits, an ongoing housing crisis, the fact that more than 70% of Haverhill Public School students are high needs, and serious attendance issues in the school district. He said he looks forward to serving on an economic development task force and improving collaboration between the city council and school committee. We will make progress, bring more businesses to our city, and more life to our downtown, Jordan said. More jobs locally will help improve the quality of life for our residents and provide relief to our taxpayers. In closing, Jordan challenged residents to engage in a civic lifestyle to help support the community. Find a way to get involved in making our city a better place to live, learn, work, and play, Jordan said. You will meet some fantastic people. You will feel a lot better about yourself in our city. It is much better use of your time than complaining about everything on a Haverhill Facebook page. Mitchitson centered his remarks on economic and workforce development, pointing to Haverhill's strengths in manufacturing, healthcare, and service economy. Jobs follow talent, Mitchitson said. That is why a central pillar of this work is branding Haverhill as a town-first city. Our primary economic tool isn't just land and tax breaks. It is the skills of our people. He also discussed his work on the Whittier Tech New Building Committee. As a vocational school prepares for a replacement or renovation, as well as a new state-mandated lottery admission system for all vocational technical schools. This change means that access to a vocational future is now a game of chance for every single student that applies, Mitchitson said. Their future now depends on a random draw rather than an open door. Mitchitson said that the city will work to expand career exploration and training opportunities to ensure students have alternatives. We ensure a no from the lottery doesn't mean a no for a career, he said. Matching business needs with student training is the ultimate win-win. The ceremony also included the inauguration of Haverhill School Committee, which welcomed unprecedented 6 new members, Penelope Guerrero, Tony Sapisa Donias, Josiah Moreau, Mercer Rivera, Robert Brown, and Amanda Bisellery. They join incumbents Maura Ryan Cirodillo, Jill Story, Yanni Collins, and Thomas Greneman. And that is it for the first half of our show. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And Lab would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUMLFM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. We will be back on shortly.
You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell, WUML, for providing the radio signal that allows us to read 5 days a week. This is Elizabeth. I'll be filling in for the rest of the show with Mary. Mary, do you want to start?
Sure. Thank you, Elizabeth. Nuon becomes vice major. Lowell, after two rounds of voting, Eric Gishner was selected by his colleagues to become the next mayor of Lowell Council. Vesna Nuon was selected by one ballot for vice major during Monday's morning inauguration ceremony at Lowell Memorial Auditorium. It was a surprise outcome to what publicly appeared to be a two-person race between previous mayor Daniel Rourke and Nuon. Gishner thanks the voters of Lowell and his colleagues for their confidence in me. I promise the citizens of Lowell that I will be held accountable. I will hold people accountable and be transparent. And I will work hard to respect our city to the best of my abilities and maintain the high level of integrity, Krishna said during his speech acceptance. The vote for the 2-year seat took place immediately following the swearing-in of 2026-2027 council, including new councillors Belinda Duran, District 3, Belvedere, Sean McDonough, District 4, Downtown Lowell, and Sidney Leon, District 7, The Acre. All three ran as independent voices and won against incumbent candidates. No candidate for major had a major majority of 6 votes in the first round of voting, which saw 5 votes for Rourke and 3 votes each for Nuon and Gishner. But by the second ballot, while Rourke held on to his 5 votes, both Leon and Nuon switched their votes to Gishner, giving him the seat. Nuon won 6 of his colleagues' votes for vice major. The same colleagues who voted for Rourke for major voted for Ron Dakota. Under the city's Plan E from the government, instead of being elected by voters, the mayor is selected by a majority of all councillors at the body's inauguration. Due to his unelected role, Lowell's mayor has untraditionally been a procedural and ceremonial one, and the mayor has no more voting authority than any other councillor. But intense backroom politicking can shift the playing field and cement alliances as well as opposing coalitions. Even before the body officially first meets to conduct the city's business Tuesday night, the mayor chairs the city council and the school committee while also representing the city as various civic functions. The ceremony was well attended by both city leadership and staff, as well as the family, friends, and supporters of the councilors. At least 3 former Lowell mayors were in attendance, including state reps Rodney Elliott, John Leahy, and Bill Martin, State Senate Vanna Howard, Lowell Public Schools Superintendent Liam Skinner, and Greater Lowell Technical High School Superintendent Director Jill Davis were also spotted. Gary opened the ceremony with a report from Election and Census Director Will Roseberry, who said, in close hearing are the results of the November 4, 2025 City of Lowell elections.
These results are duly certified by the Lowell Elections Commission, followed by the oath of office for all the counselors. Both Kishner and Nguyen had their children at their side when they took the oath, administered by Lowell District Court Judge Stephen Geary. Zachary Kishner, the son of the new mayor, and Nada Nguyen, daughter of the city's new vice mayor, each joined their parent on stage for the oath of office. He's worked really hard for the last 4 years as a counselor, Zachary Kishner said after the ceremony. He dedicated to the city, and he's not going to get pushed around by people. He's dedicated to transparency and accountability. That's what you're going to have in him as mayor. Nadia Nguyen, a Boston University student, said her father would continue his work as a great representation for the younger generations of the Asian population. In his closing remarks, Eric Kishner recognized Rourke for his service as a city mayor. He was a positive voice and represented our city very well, Kishner said. A great ambassador, and I would like to thank him for his service to the city. And the auditorium gave Rourke a standing and sustained round of applause. Lowell continues to push to be leaders, Kishner said, first in the nation to be named a front-runner city on UNESCO Learning's Lowell City on the Link Lowell Innovation Network Corridor Project. To the family and friends of elected officials, thank you for being there for all of us. The inauguration for the Lowell School Committee took place at City Hall following the City Council ceremony. The Council meets Tuesday, and the School Committee meets Wednesday in the Council Chambers. Both meetings take place starting at 6:30 p.m. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mary. Mayor urges unity in speech, offers warning. This is Methuen by Teddy Toucher. Methuen, in the inaugural speech of his first full term, Mayor D.J. Beauregard spoke of the missteps of the past and hope of the future. While Beauregard was sworn in alongside other elected city leaders Friday, the first official meeting of the new city council was held Monday night. It followed a speech with calls for officials to better represent the interests of the diverse population. As we look to the future, it is important that we never forget our past, Beauregard said at the ceremony, which was held at the Methuen Memorial Music Hall, 192 Broadway. After all, as Mark Twain once said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. It's an indisputable fact. Prior administrations and some past city councils drove Methuen into a ditch. Newly elected councilors John Drew, Ryan DiZoglio, Mike Samad, Yanilda Santos, and Ella McLaren were also sworn in alongside incumbents Ron Marzen, Nelly Soto, Patricia Valley, and Jana Zanni Pesci. Disastrous contracts, short-term thinking, and self-serving decisions nearly brought our city to the brink of financial ruin, Beauregard said. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, instead of embracing the mantra, ask not what Methuen can do for you, ask what you can do for Methuen. Too many people who held power in the city asked a very different question, what can Methuen do for me? Representatives of the school committee were also sworn in, including two new members, former assistant to the superintendent Martha Sorois and former counselor Nicholas DiZoglio. It is important to remember who Methuen belongs to. Methuen doesn't belong to whoever the mayor is. Methuen doesn't belong to whoever sits on the city council table, Beauregard said. Methuen belongs to its people. The new year brings in five new members to the nine-member council. Drew is a master plumber and is new to city politics. His candidacy drew endorsements from many of the city's labor unions. Samad, served during a previous council and currently works as a police officer in Lawrence. McLaren, 20, is also new to the council and studying political science at Merrimack College, while Ryan DiZoglio just completed a term on the school committee. Santos is also new to the council. She is a residential mortgage loan officer. Methuen belongs to every family that establishes roots here, every newcomer who chooses to make this city their home, and every resident who believes that Methuen's best days are still ahead of us, Beauregard said. The Reverend Nathaniel Burns, a close friend of former Mayor Neil Perry and pastor at the First Baptist Church, led the session in prayer Friday. Beauregard assumed the role of acting mayor after Perry's unexpected death in 2024 and then won re-election to serve out the rest of Perry's term. Despite his criticisms of past leadership, Beauregard concluded in his speech on a positive note. As we mark the 300th anniversary of Methuen's founding, it's worth remembering that this city has endured far worse than a rough comment thread on social media or a cynical post, he said. We have weathered economic upheaval, political turmoil, and moments when our future felt uncertain. Yet each time Methuen endured, not because of any individual, but because of a shared belief that the community is worth fighting for. To watch the roughly 40-minute ceremony, visit tinyurl.com/3NYT8PUR. If we stay focused, if we stay united, and if we continue to choose progress over noise, I have no doubt that Methuen's next century and its next 300 years will be even stronger than the last, Beauregard said. The first meeting of the new school committee will be held on Monday, January 12th. And there's a picture of Methuen Mayor D.J. Beauregard was sworn in for the first full term on Friday. Beauregard assumed the acting mayor after the death of former Neil Perry in the fall of 2024. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Practicing gratitude, a simple way to start the new year right. This article is written by Miriam Fossier. This new year, instead of picking up a habit that requires a fancy gym membership or new running shoes, what if you choose one that doesn't cost anything at all? Most of us show gratitude in passing, like when a barista hands over a coffee or a co-worker does a small act of kindness. But we may not know it's how doing so affects the well-being of our relationships. One thing that intrigues me about gratitude is that we often think we are doing it for others, to make others feel good, says Farnoos Nuri, a clinical assistant professor of counseling at Southern Methodist University. In reality, what it does to our body, to our immune system, to our cardiovascular health is incredible. Bringing gratitude into focus comes at a time when more than 6 out of 10 adults in the United States say social division is a significant source of stress in our lives. And half of more adults say they feel isolated and left out of lack of companionship often, or lack of time. Here is what researchers suggest about gratitude and practical ways to incorporate in your life. The origin of gratitude. Gratitude is recognizing that something good has happened and attribute it to another person, or for some, a higher power. If you know someone is intending to help you, or they are doing it for benevolent reasons because they care about you, you end up feeling more grateful, said Joanne Sung, an associate professor of psychology at Baylor University. If you suspect someone got you a gift because they're trying to manipulate you or get something from you, then your gratitude is going to be a lot lower. Sung said gratitude may have risen in human evolution to encourage reciprocity. In 1971, evolution biologist Robert Trivers coined the term reciprocal altruism, to explain why animals, especially those not related to each other, will help one another, even when it comes at a cost. Applied to humans, Tseng said that theory suggests gratitude may motivate us to return a favor, increasing the chances that both people benefit. Other research by social psychologist Sarah Algo suggests gratitude helps people find partners who are responsive to their needs, strengthening close relationships over time. Work by scientists Martin Noer and Sebastian Roche also link gratitude to a phenomenon called upstream reciprocity. When receiving help from one person makes someone more likely to be generous to someone else. Taken together, the body of gratitude research suggests that the emotion may have played an important role in human and social evolution and helps explain why it shows up across different cultures. Grateful mind, grateful body. Research suggests that expressing gratitude can best benefit the body in several ways. In the brain, it can lower levels of the stress hormone cortisol, which may be linked to less inflammation elsewhere in the body, and boosts feel-good chemicals such as dopamine and serotonin. Gratitude may also strengthen the connections between different parts of the brain, Nervi said. That could matter for conditions such as anxiety, depression, in which communication between brain regions moved and emotion regulation may be disturbed. When a person is thinking about gratitude, Nervi added, brain scans have shown increased activity in such areas. It's unclear, however, whether practicing gratitude can meaningfully improve mental health conditions. A 2021 review of 70 studies found that people who reported higher levels of gratitude tended to report lower levels of depression. By a 2020 review of studies found gratitude-based interventions produce only a small improvement in depression and anxiety, suggesting people should still pursue conventional treatment rather than focusing on gratitude alone. Other benefits of gratitude include better cardiovascular health. A 2022 study found that gratitude and optimism were linked to a drop in heart rate and blood pressure. Gratitude can even help our sleep. A 2009 study found that grateful people go to bed with fewer stressful or negative thoughts that keep them awake, and with more calm, positive thoughts that make it easier to fall asleep. Tips on practicing gratitude. Ready to show more gratitude in your life? Nervi and Tseng recommended the following tips. Keep a journal to write down what you're grateful for. This can help build a habit of seeing good things in your day-to-day life. Write a letter to someone in your life saying you are grateful for them and give it to them. You not only get the awareness of what you're grateful for, but because you're giving it to someone else, you get to see their reaction. Tseng said, it strengthens your relationship. If letter writing isn't your style, text three people you're grateful for and tell them why you are. Take a deep breath before expressing gratitude. This can help relax the mind and reduce stress, Nervi said. Don't force gratitude, especially in situations where you do not feel valued or appreciated. If your needs are not being met and you're trying to address that by just being grateful, then that can also be an unhealthy thing, Tseng said. Over to you, Christina. I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
We're making you confused today, switching seats all the time. Thank you, Mary. I have two short articles. One, today in history, January 6th. Trump supporters storm the Capitol to stop certification of Biden victory. This is by the Associated Press. Today is Tuesday, January 6th, the sixth day of 2026. There are 359 days left in the year, and today in history, On January 6, 2021, supporters of Donald Trump, fueled by false claims of a stolen election, assaulted police and stormed into the U.S. Capitol to interrupt the certification of Democrat Joe Biden's victory, forcing lawmakers into hiding. A Trump supporter, Ashley Babbitt, was shot and killed by police as she tried to breach a barricaded doorway inside the Capitol. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, injured while confronting rioters, suffered a stroke the next day and died from natural causes. Congress reconvened hours later to finish certifying Biden's victory. In January 2025, on the first day of his second term, Trump granted blanket clemency to the more than 1,500 people convicted or awaiting trial or sentencing for January 6th offenses. Also on this date, in 1919, former President Theodore Roosevelt died in Oyster Bay, New York, at age 60. In 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address, outlined a goal of four freedoms: human rights worthy of defending universally, freedom of speech and expression, the freedom of worship, to worship God in one's own way, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. In 1974, year-round daylight savings time began in the United States on a trial basis as a fuel-saving measure in response to OPEC oil embargo. The country, however, returned to standard time in October, effectively ending the experiment. In 1982, truck driver William G. Bonin was convicted in Los Angeles of 10 of the freeway killer slayings of young men and boys. Bonin was later convicted of four other killings and was executed in 1996. In 1994, figure skater Nancy Kerrigan was clubbed on the leg by an assailant at the Detroit's Cobo Arena. Four men, including the ex-husband of Kerrigan's rival, Tonya Harding, went to prison for their roles. Harding pleaded guilty to conspiracy to hinder prosecution, but denied any advance knowledge of the assault. In 2025, former Ku Klux Klan leader Edgar Ray Killen was indicted on murder charges 41 years after the civil rights workers were killed in Mississippi. Killen was later convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 60 years in prison. He died in prison in 2018. Today's birthdays: actor-comedian Rowan Atkinson, who played Mr. Bean, is 71. Golf Hall of Famer Nancy Lopez is 69. TV chief Nigella Lawson is 66. Former Football Hall of Famer Howie Long is 66. Football Hall of Famer Charles Haley is 62. Actor Norman Reedus is 57. TV personality Julie Chen Moonves is 56. Actor Ed Redmayne is 44. Actor comedian Kate McKinnon is 42. Businessman Eric Trump is 42. Entrepreneur and yoga instructor Hilaria Baldwin is 42 as well. And then today in Dear Abby, family chooses a side amid amicable divorce. Dear Abby, my wife's nephew is getting divorced. The process seems to be amicable. There was no cheating or abuse. They have two children, even though the soon-to-be ex, Michelle, has always been welcoming and nice. My wife's family has circled the wagons. They no longer talk to her and have made clear I can't either. I don't think that that's right. Michelle has done nothing wrong and has been cordial to us. My wife says to stay out of it and never contact her. I think that's immature. I realize my thoughts don't matter. However, I'm thinking about contacting Michelle to say I feel bad about being in that position and apologize. I think if I did, I'd feel better about myself, and she'd know that everyone doesn't hate her. Should something happen to my wife's nephew, I would have some basis for connection to the children. What do you think? Signed, Navigating Change in Illinois. Dear Navigating, I think you are more mature than your wife's family. You are an adult, and you should do what you feel is right. Dear Abby, my father left our family when I was in the sixth grade because he had cheated on our mom numerous times. He was removed from his ministry and went into education. I tried to resolve my feelings with him, but he would never admit his faults. When I finally asked him to tell me the truth, he refused. I am now in my 60s and still angry at him. I have a wonderful wife and two beautiful kids he has never met. Before he dies, I'd like to tell him how I feel about him and ask him one more time to tell the truth. Is this worth the effort? He is 92. I don't have much time. Signed, Angry, still in Pennsylvania. Dear Angry, your efforts will be better spent if you meet with your father and tell him you forgive him for his transgressions. Do this not for him, but for yourself, to free you from the burden of anger you have carried for all of these years. You will continue to carry after his demise. Dear Abby, how does one approach by phone, email, or a person, a couple, close friends of many years, whose husband is slipping into dementia? Do we acknowledge and commiserate, pretend nothing is amiss, stop communicating, or see them? Or what exactly? The profound tragedy is that the husband has been an intellectual and executive giant of immense quality with abundant gifts and skills. Watching this slow-motion tragedy unfold is agonizing, not knowing what to say or do compounds the pain. Signed, Delivering Painful News. Dear Delivering, social isolation is a killer. People in their early middle stages of dementia are capable of being social. What you should continue to do is be the friend to you, this couple that you have always been, and take your guidance from the wife. She will appreciate your kindness and support during this difficult time. Over to you, Mary.
Holocaust survivor Eva Schloss dies at 96. London. Auschwitz survivor Eva Schloss, the stepsister of teenage diarist Anne Frank, and a tireless educator about the horrors of the Holocaust, has died. She was 96. The Anne Frank Trust, UK, of which Schloss was honorary president, said she died Saturday in London, where she lived. Britain's King Charles III said he was privileged and proud to have known Schloss, who co-founded the Charitable Trust to help young people challenge prejudice. The horrors that she endured as a young woman are impossible to comprehend, and yet she devoted the rest of her life to overcoming hatred and prejudice, promoting kindness, courage, understanding, and resilience through her tireless work for the Anne Frank Trust, UK, and for Holocaust education across the world, the King said. Born Eva Gerringer in Vienna in 1929, Schloss fled with her family to Amsterdam after Nazi Germany annexed Austria. She became friends with a Nova Jewish girl at the same age, Anne Frank, whose diary would become one of the most famous chronicles of the Holocaust. Like the Franks, Eva's family spent 2 years in hiding to avoid capture after the Nazis occupied the Netherlands. They were eventually betrayed, arrested, and sent to the Auschwitz death camp. Schloss and her mother, Fitzy, survived until the camp was liberated by Soviet troops in 1945. Her father, Erich, and brother, Heinz, died in Auschwitz. After the war, Eva moved to Britain, married German Jewish refugee Steve Schlott, and settled in London. In 1953, her mother married Frank's father, Otto, the only member of his immediate family to survive. Anne Frank died of typhus in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp at age of 15 months before the end of the war. Schloss did not speak publicly about her experiences for decades, later saying that wartime trauma made her withdrawn and unable to connect with others. I was silent for years, at first because I wasn't allowed to speak. Then I repressed it. I was angry with the world, she told the Associated Press in 2004. But after she addressed the opening of an Anne Frank exhibition in London in 1986, Schloss made it her mission to educate younger generations about the Nazi genocide. Over the following decades, she spoke in schools, in prisons, at international conferences, and told her story in books, including Eva's Story, a survivor's tale by the stepsister of Anne Frank. She kept campaigning into her 90s, and in 2019, she traveled to Newburyport Beach, California, to meet teenagers who were photographed making Nazi salutes at a high school party. The following year, she was part of a campaign urging Facebook to remove Holocaust-denying material from the social networking site. We must never forget the terrible consequences of treating people as other souls did in 2024. We need to respect everybody's races and religions. We need to live together with our differences. The only way to achieve this is through education, and the younger we start, the better. Schloss family remember her as a remarkable woman, an ostrich survivor, a devoted Holocaust educator, tireless in her work for remembrance, understanding, and peace. We hope her legacy will continue to inspire through books, films, and resources she leaves behind. The family said in a statement, C.V. Schloss died in 2016. Eva Schloss is survived by their three daughters, as well as grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Quickly read the horoscopes for today. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. Take pride in what you do, sticking to the basics and setting a budget. And setting a budget are necessary if you want to get ahead. Challenge yourself first before questioning others. Aquarius, January 20th through February 19th. Dream on. But when it comes to enforcing change, you're best off taking a wait and see approach. Your gestures will buy favors when you are in need yourself. Pisces, February 20th to March 28th. Spontaneity can lead to trouble. Don't make promises you cannot deliver. Participate in groups or events that allow you to promote your beliefs or skills, and something good will come of it. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. Authenticity will help you bring about much-needed change. An opportunity is within reach, but it's up to you to set things off. Stop talking and start doing. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th. Keep up with technology and the latest upgrades in your field of service. Whether you are pursuing knowledge, working hard to earn a living, or are retired, it is important not to lose sight of your advancement. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. You may crave change, but before making a bold move, consider consequences. Emotions will lead you down the wrong path, offering less than you anticipate with little recourse. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Take the plunge and adjust whatever isn't living up to your expectations. Set standards that make you feel proud and can help you reach your target. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Be a leader and put your energy and effort into something that will benefit you. Refuse to get wrapped up in someone else's dreams or be talked into something you don't want or need. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Step up and make a difference. Your insight and ability to find solutions will give you the edge you need in competitive situations. Someone you encounter will pique your interest. Libra, September 23rd through October 23rd. Keep a close watch. Note what others are doing and put your energy where it matters most. Consider what you need to know or learn in order to do your best. Scorpio, October 24th through November 22nd. A level head and an open mind will help you navigate your way through sticky situations. Time and money are essential. Wasting either will put you in a precarious position. And finally, Sagittarius, November 23rd through December 21st. Trust yourself, not what others tells you. Say no to people offering the impossible or making empty promises. Taking on minimalistic lifestyle will ease your mind and give you more time to do what you enjoy most. And thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information from our radio reading service, call 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 631-359-9069, or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Christina, Elizabeth, and Mary reading for you this morning, wishing you a wonderful day, and thank you for listening. Have a great day. Bye-bye.